to the session on law reform in the context of HIV. Are human rights protected or compromised? My name is Sophia Gruskin, and it seems as though we're going to have a wonderful panel with a great set of talks. Before beginning, I want to say that our third speaker is going to be speaking in Russian, and so you'll need to get headsets unless you speak Russian, and the headsets are right outside. So please make sure that you get them as the session is about to begin. So we're going to begin, and just to say a few words of introduction, which is that essentially these presentations ask us to consider two critical questions. What is the nature and purpose of law reform, and is law reform always and inherently a good thing? Many of us actually push for law reform when we see laws that by their very nature violate human rights. But one can ask, is that always the right approach? In some cases, is it better to leave bad law on the books if it's not actually being enforced? Or is it always better to push for change, even if we're not actually sure what directions the changes in the law are going to take? This is particularly of concern when changes in the law may actually result in something worse than what you started with. Worse for women, worse for key populations. And this is the case in places where there's been no law to begin with, as well as in places where bad law just is not being enforced. The presentations that you're going to hear tackle these sorts of questions with a range of different sorts of examples. And what I'd like to highlight before turning it over to the panel is that in places where rights are compromised by the laws that are in place, these restrictions of rights are often justified as being necessary to achieve public health goals. But the reality is that beyond their stated justification, the law is often used to enforce moral, religious, or cultural standards. And what is prescribed, how it's defined, how it's written, and how it's understood is wildly different across different jurisdictions, even though we tend to talk about law under one rubric. For example, we talk about sodomy laws, but within that, there's great diversity in terms of what's included. And in the context of HIV, even though there may be moral or religious reasons at play for what's really going on, the fact is that the law is often being justified as necessary for public health, which can, under human rights law, be a valid justification for restricting rights. So it's a need to be able to ask beyond the stated public health justification, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence from a public health perspective that the law and the direction that it's taking is good and that it's necessary? And in particular, because these laws, and here we're thinking about things like criminalization of sex work or of drug use, for example, because these laws often have serious negative impacts on HIV prevention and care efforts, it's worth keeping in mind that contrary to their stated justification, there's generally no public health evidence to support prescribing the particular behavior employers or the activities. And just to highlight the point that despite any stated justifications, the public health evidence is pretty overwhelming that one needs to ensure that law supports and doesn't hinder the ability of all people to access and use HIV prevention and care services. And so even in public health terms, law should be about promoting and protecting human rights, not about restricting them. So with that as a backdrop, just to say this is an incredibly rich session with a range of examples highlighting the good and the bad of law reform in HIV efforts, particularly for the rights of women and for key populations. In terms of the logistics of the session, each presenter has been given 10 minutes, and we've agreed that I'm to be fairly strict about the time in order to ensure that we have plenty of time for discussion afterwards. And again, just to note for people who have come into the room late that our third speaker will be speaking in Russian, so ensure people that need headsets that you have the headsets that you need. So without further ado, can I just introduce our first speaker, Sodi White, who will talk about the experience from Malawi in using law reform as a tool to advance women's human rights. She is a social development lawyer, a socio-legal researcher, and a writer on women's human rights. And as an African feminist and director of Women in the Law in Southern Africa Research and Education Trust, she's been influential in achieving groundbreaking law reform to protect women's rights and in promoting women's access to justice in Malawi and throughout Southern Africa. She is a commissioner on the Special Law Commission on Gender-Related Laws, Malawi Law Commission, and in 2004, she received the Malawi Human Rights Commission Award for her contribution to the advancement of women's rights and children's rights in Malawi. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Sophia. As Sophia has said, my name is Sodi White. I'm from Malawi. My presentation today relates to law reform as a tool to advance women's rights in the context of HIV, and I would like to share experience from Malawi, which is my country, which I love very much. I'd first like to tender my sincere gratitude to the organizers of this conference, and in particular the organizers of this session, for inviting me to come and present this case study. This case study is based on a legal challenge in which Women and Law in Southern Africa Research Trust Malawi, WILSA Malawi, the organization that I serve, is challenging the current approach to marital property because it violates provisions of Malawi's constitution which prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex and mandates women's rights to property, particularly upon the end of marriage. I also presented this case study in Washington, D.C. at the Women Deliver Conference in June this year, just in case there's someone who was there. Now, in Malawi, the current legal position with regards to women's property rights, particularly women's property rights in marriage, is as follows. Section 24(1)(b)(1) of the Malawi's constitution provides that women are entitled to a fair disposition of property that is held jointly, and that's my emphasis, with a husband upon the dissolution of such marriage. However, the current interpretation of Section 17 of Malawi's Married Women's Property Act, which is a statute of general application, it's an 1882 statute which we inherited directly from the British. The British have done away with it, but we still use it. Now, this particular law only considers property to be held jointly if a direct financial contribution has been made to its acquisition. This is people who are married. And therefore, the courts have actually used largely this kind of interpretation of the Constitution as well as using the Married Women's Property Act. Now, what is the issue here? Since case law, that is the cases from the High Court, has shown that courts in Malawi do not recognize household and caregiving work that women often perform during marriage as an economic activity that contributes to the acquisition or maintenance of family assets, many women return virtually nothing upon the end of a marriage, be it an end through death or divorce. This is because property is well registered in their name, or they cannot prove a direct economic contribution to its acquisition or maintenance. Now, what is the relationship between property rights and, you know, and HIV/AIDS? This is the connection. Now, if you look at the interpretation of the courts, and if you look at the law as it stands today in Malawi, the approach that the courts have taken to marital property has been criticized for the hardships and injustices that it is capable of producing and has many times produced, in particular for women. I have so many clients who come to my office, and this is the critical issue: the division of property upon divorce, the division of property upon death. It causes serious hardships for women. And equal marital property rights can affect women's economic autonomy, security, dignity, and health by reinforcing women's dependence on their husbands. Numerous studies have demonstrated how the fear of poverty and insecurity inhibits women, including those who are married, from engaging in safe sex or from living violent relationships, and therefore making them more vulnerable to contracting HIV. Women with access to resources, including land and property, are better able to negotiate condom use in their sexual relationships, to provide for their own and their children's needs, and to leave abusive partners. Upon marriage dissolution, women without access to marital property may face daunting difficulties in terms of securing a place to live, maintaining a basis for survival, and accessing economic opportunities. This may drive women to engage in behaviors that put them at increased risk of contracting HIV. Now, that's the connection. So what are we doing about it as WILSA Malawi? Like I said, we have got this legal challenge going on as we speak. What the essence of the legal challenge is that we are requesting the Constitutional Court of Malawi to declare Section 17 of the Married Women's Property Act invalid, or in the alternative, to declare that Section 17 be interpreted in a manner that recognizes women's contributions to marital property and guarantees women receive half the marital assets upon the end of a marriage. What we are hoping, that is the desirable outcome, is that we hope that the Constitutional Court will rise to the occasion and use this opportunity to clarify the guarantees that the Constitution of the Republic of Malawi has in place to protect women's marital property rights. In our opinion, the court can do this by recognizing the household and caregiving work that women often perform during a marriage as an important and valuable activity that contributes to the acquisition or maintenance of family assets. Therefore, unless a couple contracts out of this approach, that a couple chooses not to be bound by this approach that we hope the court will arrive at, marital property shall be deemed to be owned and controlled equally by parties to the marriage. Therefore, in the long run, we hope that women's rights will be protected, that women's property rights will be protected, and in turn, because women have the security of property, they have the security of economic prowess, they can negotiate a better relationship, they can live a violent marriage, and they can, in effect, avoid or take measures to protect themselves from contracting HIV. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that case study, and good luck on the case. Our next speaker is Nandini Bantapadai, who's an independent consultant working on issues of class, sexuality, and gender, with a particular focus on community engagement and political mobilization of marginalized populations. Since 1995, she's worked closely with sex worker organizations and afterwards with men who have sex with men, with transgender people, and with people who use drugs. She has expertise in participatory research, in capacity building, and in developing dialogue-based interpersonal communications methods and tools for assessing and addressing HIV vulnerabilities amongst key populations, and she's currently a member of the UNAIDS Advisory Group on HIV and Sex Work. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you, everybody, for coming, and thank you to the organizers for having this session and having me on the session. I'll speak from here because I'm not speaking to PowerPoint, and what I'd like to do is raise three questions. I've worked with sex workers mostly in India and Bangladesh, and through my work I've had the opportunity to interact with sex worker leaders from across the world. So my questions are informed by my experience and the interactions I've had. My first question is, while it is often right and strategic to frame sex workers' rights and rights of other key populations to legal equality and enfranchisement within the context of public health, is it enough? After all, sex workers, like everybody else, I mean, their rights are absolute, indivisible, and universal. So how long do we have to justify their rights in terms of delivering public good? Why are they not enough in themselves? Sometimes it's quite right, as Sophia just said, that ensuring rights of sex workers and other key populations is good for public health. There are many examples. There's good evidence now to show that empowering sex workers with legal rights and empowering them to have social access, social inclusion, reduces their risk to HIV. Sonagachi Project of Sex Workers in India is an example I know particularly closely, but there are other examples across the world. So it's quite right that protecting rights of key populations, particularly sex workers, lead to good public health results. Sometimes it's also strategic to argue for key populations' rights, argue for sex workers' rights in particular, within using the language, couching it in the language of public health. In many contexts, in many countries, it is the only platform available to sex workers to do so with a relative degree of safety and with the chance of being heard at all. So sometimes for sex workers' organizations, it's a strategic route to take. But what makes me apprehensive of that particular strategy is that often public health, the logic of public health, can infringe on those rights. In India, for example, there's a drive to scale up what we call parent-to-child, prevention of parent-to-child transmission, PMTCT. Anyway, so in the sort of attempt to scale PMTCT, all women who come to antenatal clinics in private and public facilities, including sex workers, are routinely and compulsorily tested for HIV without any appropriate counseling and consent. So while scaling up PMTCT is an obviously good public health strategy, it can lead to gross violations of rights of sex workers. The global environment which encourages provider-initiated counseling and treatment is another case in point, where rights of vulnerable populations, marginalized populations, populations who are perceived to be at risk of HIV, would be routinely and necessarily abused through provider-initiated testing, counseling and testing in countries like India, for example. To give another kind of example of where public health logic may act against the interest of sex workers' rights, when the commission, the report of the Commission on AIDS in Asia came out, it clearly identified that key populations, including sex workers, are most at risk of HIV. So that is where the investment should be in HIV response. While many of many sex workers groups in Asia and their allies rejoiced. Many donors considered withdrawing funding from HIV in Asia because in the absence of a potential generalized epidemic, there would not be enough bang for the buck. So my question and probably my answer is that probably we have to talk about sex workers' right to health as an universal entitlement and not merely instrumentally as serving public health goals. The second question is about where punitive laws, practices and enforcement of those laws actually infringes on sex workers' rights. What should we do? Obviously, when those laws actively and routinely harasses sex workers, those laws have to be removed. But but within a punitive environment, decriminalizing one aspect of sex work can leave open the possibility of penalizing other aspects of sex work, which can still violate sex workers' rights and challenge their well-being. I'll give an Indian example again. Indian sex workers have long fought for decriminalization of sex work. And recently, a couple of years back, it seemed as if the government is paying heed to their demands. So there was a proposal to amend the Immoral Trafficking Prevention Act, that is the act under the Indian Penal Code which regulates trafficking and by default sex work. And what they did, listening to the demand of sex workers, they proposed to decriminalize soliciting, for example. But at the same time, in the name of protecting sex workers, they proposed to criminalize clients. So sex workers across the country rallied together and mobilized against that proposed bill, and with their legal activist allies managed to stall and eventually kill the bill. But the threat remains. For example, in Argentina now, there is a similar proposal afoot for criminalizing clients, again in the name of promoting and protecting sex workers' rights. And often sex workers are quite arbitrarily harassed, arrested, and put in jail under a range of laws which has nothing to do with sex work per se. So it's about loitering or creating public nuisance or vagrancy or something or the other. So removing the punitive laws in themselves are not enough. More often, sex workers are arrested and extorted for money and so on without recourse to any law. So law enforcers, whether they're public law enforcers or whether they're private ones, vigilantes and moral police and so on, religious police and so on, they don't need to cite any law to harass sex workers. So their removing punitive laws is obviously not going to work. So here probably again is whether our focus should be on creating an enabling legal and policy environment, and more broadly to ensuring sex workers' access to justice rather than creating, removing, reforming laws, restricting our attempts and efforts to that. Finally, the question of decriminalization. Decriminalization, yes, but to what extent? What sex workers' organizations and activists and rights activists are saying is that for decriminalizing to work for sex workers, sex work has to be decriminalized in all its aspects. It cannot be a piecemeal halfway attempt. Selling and buying of sexual services, facilitating that, such sexual transactions, sex workers' autonomy over using the income from sex work, all of that need to be decriminalized. That is, we need to accept the underlying principle that sex work, like any other work, leads to rights of organized labor. And labor rights of sex workers have to be protected. In any other business, no other business, agents are penalized. In no other business, managers of the business are penalized. So if a sex worker decides to use an agent or a pimp to help her contract a client, or if she chooses to work with a brothel manager rather than trying it out on her own, all of that needs to be legally protected, therefore decriminalized. I was thinking of when we talk about self-determination of nations, self-determination of people. I mean, I'm going back to Lenin here a little while. We talked about self-determination up to cessation. I was looking for a language which says decriminalization up to sort of something, a total autonomy. So those are the three questions I want to leave you with. And they, I talked from the context of sex workers, and that's the population I've worked most closely with. But I'm sure it will have resonances and relevance for other key populations. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Irina Maslova from St. Petersburg, Russia, and she's going to talk on drug use, harm reduction, and HIV risk. And again, she will be speaking in Russian. She's a program coordinator at Humanitarian Action, which is based in St. Petersburg, and has a longstanding experience in HIV prevention work with sex workers, as well as injecting drug users. Since 2008, she's been involved as a trainer and a consultant with UNFPA, focusing on issues of service provision for women engaged in high-risk behaviors. She's also the coordinator of Silver Rose, a self-help group of sex workers, and an active member of SWAN, a sex worker rights advocacy network in Central Eastern Europe and Central Asia. Irina?
Unfortunately, yes. Я 5 years, for 5 years, practically every day, so I report in St. Petersburg, in Russia, and then visit many, many places around each and every day to propagate our program of harm reduction. We want to reduce risks of our clients, of people who visit us, who turn to us for help. All, whoever, and we ride a bus, so whoever enters our bus can ask us about mitigating the risk. This is, of course, exchange of needles, of syringes, the possibility of rehabilitation, of OST, and many other things. But there's a but to it. All those years, we had those programs of harm reduction. Under this global fund, the state looked down, it snows, wonderful, beautiful, somebody's taking care of that. But when the global fund went away because our projects ended, and all those organizations just started to stop their work, very useful work, because there was no funding. In our country, we don't have adequate real medical help or treatment for a drug dependency. Or in Russia, you are not allowed to speak about OST. And if we have other projects, then we are all afraid that police will just charge against us. And Alexandre, this is medicine that helps in cases of overdose. It's not allowed. It's illegal. And all our principles, all our our prophylactic methods are connected with health care, with human rights, and our harm reduction program beginning from 2007. The organization was the first who practically introduced harm reduction programs in Russia. But it's not a lot with our legislation, doesn't go well with our legislation. And then our government and healthcare institutions don't look at us very positively. You have to understand, in Russia, a drug addict or a drug user is somebody outside of the law. All the laws that are in Russia, all other acts, normative acts, and they are not valid for which HIV positive people, and that's why people don't want to come out, because then otherwise they won't have any legislation, and they all say you have to adhere to laws, but about what laws we speak? If we speak about sex workers, if they take away their condoms and they just stop their possibilities getting condoms, how can they adhere to laws? The condoms that we have, they are not certified. And then I ask girls from Kyrgyzstan or from the Ukraine, I imported of really good condoms, but this is of course illegal import, and then with it, they have been confiscated 400 pieces, 500 items. Then they're just confiscated because they are going to street work, to sex workers, and this is not allowed. And when the Global Fund left the country, then nobody took over. The state didn't want it. And I don't know to who to turn, that sex workers and drug users and MSMs. Who dare to carry a risk group? I would really like to slap that person very strongly. As soon as you tell somebody, I'm a sex worker, then they look at you as, oh, you are somebody who will infect me. But at least half of the sex workers are not infected. As soon as you know that somebody is a drug user, for all this, it is logical, this is a stigma, a social stigma, because he is somehow transmitting the virus, and so on. There are many we could prove that our programs are effective and they are very good, that evidence-based. But unfortunately, our government does not take it into account. If there are Russians, they'll attack me afterwards. In December last year, we asked the Global Fund of Russia, please come back to Russia, help us. We thought about our clients, about the people who are already infected, who already are HIV positive. And the Global Fund, it was like a death sentence for those people, and I think that was wrong, because if a person is just in between living or dying, then of course he starts to fight for his or her rights. He wants to remain a human being. He wants to have access to medical care, to medical services, but to care and to prophylactic measures. Unfortunately, Russia is a very funny country and a very ununderstandable country. The human rights and the law and legislations, we do have laws that are protecting people, unfortunately, again, but we don't have a praxis to put them to work, to implement them. This morning, I showed a film about violating street sex workers, how they're being violated, or by drug users. We do not have any practice to implement laws that already exist and that in theory should protect everybody. The gender part. This harm reduction program is working in Russia, but in a very small part of it, in some regions, and where we don't have the Global Fund, she said, it's very difficult for drug users and for sex workers. They don't have access to that medical care, to clean needles, to condoms. And the drug users and the street workers are discriminated against. They are violated against it. And they are just discriminated. There's a huge gender gap. Thank you for your attention. I'll be gladly answer your questions if there will be any. We try to go for the decriminalization of sex workers and would like to draw from the experience of other countries. And we would like that adopting a law, we would like to work with it and would like that our voices listened to. Thank you. I don't know how it will happen, but with your help, it might happen.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Felicita Hickam, who will be speaking about advocacy efforts to respond to law reform trends in Africa, and in particular the current trends towards anti-homosexuality legislation. She is the program manager at the AIDS Rights Alliance of Southern Africa, ARASA, and she's also a member of the UNAIDS PCB NGO delegation. She's the alternative delegate for Africa. And as a rights advocate, she's been actively involved in the development and implementation of advocacy responses to a wide range of law reform trends in Southern Africa and globally. Felicita?
Thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction. Good afternoon, everybody. My presentation this afternoon is on advocacy for law reform on anti-homosexuality legislation in the context of HIV in Africa. I will begin with a background of the legislative environment with regards to same-sex relationships. I will then talk about main arguments for criminalization of same-sex relationships and using a case study from Namibia and some lessons learned from the ARASA partnership, I will reflect on the advocacy initiatives that we've taken for legal reform in Southern Africa when it comes to criminalization of same-sex sexual intercourse and relationships. Although the remit of my presentation was on MSM, and which is men who have sex with men, and excuse me for getting some of the acronyms in there. It's kind of tedious to say men who have sex with men all the time, so I will use the acronym MSM for men who have sex with men, and I will use the acronym WSW for women who have sex with women. Although the remit of my presentation was on MSM, I've taken the liberty to include references to women who have sex with women, who are also affected by this repressive legal environment. Currently, there are 38 countries in Africa that have laws that criminalize same-sex behavior. However, on May 8, 1996, which was quite historical on the African continent, South Africa became the first country in the world to enshrine lesbian and gay rights in its constitution. This has then subsequently allowed for further realization of other rights, such as the right to marry. However, there is a trend on the continent to introduce new laws that criminalize same-sex behavior or provisions for harsher sentences. And I think this goes back to Sophia's question around legal reform, and is it always a good thing? And I think the recent trends that we've seen in terms of existing legislation that was made harsher is an indication that legal reform is not always a good thing, and that we need to be proactive in terms of processes and being on top of processes when legal reform is being discussed. Punishment for homosexuality and same-sex behavior ranges from imprisonment from about 5 years to life imprisonment in Kenya, Senegal, Ghana, for example. Uganda has life imprisonment to death in countries such as Mauritania, Sudan, and parts of Nigeria. In countries that have no specific criminal penalties For same-sex conduct, however, authorities have detained suspects under a variety of laws, including public indecency, such as in Mali, and debauchery in Egypt. Some of the arguments that we've been hearing lately, because there has been a reverberating occurrence and coverage of this issue in the newspapers lately, with a trend that was started particularly in Uganda at the end of last year, when a bill was proposed to introduce the death sentence in certain instances. But some of the arguments that we've been hearing for criminalization of same-sex behavior include that homosexuality is unnatural, that it's definitely un-African, and that it's against African culture, religion, and values. And some of the advocacy that ARASA, the organization that I work with, the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa, has been working on recently, is a policy brief that tries to debunk all these arguments and that tries to make this information accessible to grassroots organizations when they are having community dialogues on the subject. So we're looking at each of these arguments individually and putting forth arguments that anybody can use when they engage in a conversation around same-sex relationships and same-sex sexual behavior. But history has also shown that same-sex sexual practice in Africa has been recorded even as far as pre-colonial days. And criminal laws, therefore, against homosexuality are the legacy of colonialism and not homosexuality itself. This legal environment, this repressive legal environment, has caused for rates amongst men who have sex with men and women who have sex with women being significantly higher than the general population, and current HIV interventions being non-existent or definitely not sufficient. And some of the arguments for why this HIV response towards key populations, particularly women who have sex with women and men who have sex with men, has been insufficient is that there's just not any data. So the argument that we've been hearing a lot is also that there is no homosexuality here. So many of the countries are claiming that because it's not visible, because it's not been recorded, that there is no homosexuality in their context. In our advocacy, we have recognized the need to repeal and amend the laws prohibiting sexual acts between consenting adults in private, to enforce anti-discrimination legislation, to provide legal services, and to promote campaigns that address homophobia, because in our context, there is a rampant existence of homophobia and a deeply ingrained sense of homophobia across society as a whole. But we also urge governments to know their epidemics by ensuring proper surveillance. So we were very excited to be part of processes such as the UNGAS Indicator Review that looks at particularly whether sufficient indicators and sufficient data is being reported on key populations such as men who have sex with men. We also advocate for the establishment and strengthening of networks of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, and intersex people, because we believe that instead of having people speak for them, they should be at the lead of interventions that respond to their needs in terms of the AIDS response. We also call for funding of interventions targeted to the needs of MSM and other LGBTI communities, and we're very excited to know about the recent Global Fund guidelines and considerations for the next round of the replenishment that would look at the needs of key populations and the funding needs for programs for key populations. In terms of advocacy for law reform, we've realized that it's a very time-consuming process, that it's very labor-intensive and very resource-intensive in terms of financial resources as well, that it's politically complex and it's often fraught with risks. And that goes back to the question of, is it always a good thing? And do you sometimes, in the process, leave it open for unintended consequences or unintended outcomes? We also realize that efforts spent may bear very little result if the law is not implemented and not accessible to those who actually need it. We've also realized that it needs to be based on an expansive legal audit, and that it should be as much that the process of legal reform should be as important as the content. And I'll talk about that a bit later when I reflect on the working group that's been set up in Namibia to address punitive laws. Some of the lessons that we've learned in the advocacy that ARASA's been doing for legal reform is that we need to get on the same page regarding our commitments and understanding of human rights. And this is particularly targeted at civil society groups who engage in this advocacy. It's an opportunity for us to challenge our own internal prejudices and our understanding of what human rights really is and who we think should be entitled to health as a human right. We come across often that human rights activists would say, I'm a human rights activist as long as I don't have to speak up for sex workers or injecting drug users or men who have sex with men. We also believe and have learned in some of our work in terms of debunking some of the arguments that it's quite important for African civil society groups to be at the forefront of advocacy for law reform on same-sex sexual behavior because of this sense that, and this argument that it's a Western agenda and that it's not an agenda that's led by African groups and that there are no homosexuals in our countries. But we also realize that much more work needs to be done on working with lawmakers, with judges, and with law enforcement. And I think that some of my colleagues previously have alluded to that as well. We recognize that more resources are needed to access justice, to make access to justice achievable for all population groups. And that we also need to look at alternative resolution mechanisms such as human rights commissions. One of the things that we are particularly strong advocates for is that men who have sex with men and women who have sex with women should be empowered to know and claim their rights. And that also cuts across other advocacy work that we're doing with other populations, such as people living with HIV and AIDS and the general population. We believe strongly in Know Your Rights campaigns and actually getting the community to understand what their rights are and where they can seek redress. But we've also realized that in our context, it's very important to work with the media because there's been, ever since some of the recent legislative trends have been reported on, it's always been sensational, and it has in many, many instances continued to fuel homophobia. In Namibia, we have recently, towards the end of last year, started engaging in a dialogue that has led to the establishment of a multi-stakeholder platform that brings together Ministry of Justice, that brings together Ministry of Health, civil society, and is led and chaired by the groups of affected populations, including men who have sex with men and women who have sex with women. This working group meets on a monthly basis and was formed to look at the existence of a number of laws and regulations that discriminate on the basis of HIV/AIDS status and or obstruct access to comprehensive services. And we realized that it is a very lengthy process, but that we are one step ahead because we have started the dialogue. And some of the key players, such as the Ministry of Justice and the Ministry of Health, are at the table. We've also realized that the working group should be based on an attempt to remove all HIV/AIDS discriminatory laws, policies, regulations, guidelines, and practices through law reform, supporting an enabling environment, and awareness raising. So those are the three pillars, but the activities under those pillars include legal support, so offering legal aid to people living with HIV and AIDS and same-sex people in same-sex couples. Also including legal audits and law reform programs. So there's a specific working group that looks at that. Also rolling out Know Your Rights campaigns, human rights training, as well as stigma and discrimination reduction programs and programs that focus on gender norms and eliminating gender-based violence. That is the end of my presentation.
Thank you. Our final speaker is Joanna Keller, who will examine the setbacks and successes of law reform for women in the context of criminalization of HIV transmission. Joanna is the director of the AIDS Legal Network, a South African human rights organization. And as a rights activist, researcher, and trainer, she's worked over the years to highlight the gendered barriers to accessing rights and available resources. She's developed resources and training materials on human rights and HIV and written on many issues in human rights, gender, and HIV, as well as conducting and participating in research projects exploring women's realities and risks in the context of HIV prevention, testing, treatment, care, and support. She has been actively involved in the research and advocacy activities on the legislative trends towards criminalization of HIV transmission and exposure and its impacts on women. And she's one of the drafters of the 10 Reasons Why Criminalization of HIV Exposure and Transmission Harms Women. Joanna?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. I will, in my intro, looking at women and the criminalization of HIV transmission, provide a short overview of the legislative trends itself, focusing specifically on the African continent, raise some discussions on the implications specifically for women, and will conclude by sharing some thoughts as to potential law reform setbacks and successes within the specific context of HIV criminalization. I would like to think that many of us in this room would agree that laws which criminalize HIV, exposure and or transmission of HIV, are fundamentally unjust and ineffective public health policy, are a threat to human rights, and have an adverse impact on women and women's risks to both HIV and to rights abusers. Despite growing concerns among many about the impact of these laws on people's lives, public health goals, and human rights obligations, legislative trends to criminalize HIV transmission and exposure continue globally, and especially on the African continent, with more than 20 countries having passed legislation to this effect and/or are in the process of drafting and passing legislation. While country-specific legislation may differ as to its clauses specifying the so-called criminal behavior and or act, criminalization laws are commonly linked to mandatory and or HIV compulsory testing. For example, the law in Guinea is requiring premarital testing, and most of the African countries are requesting mandatory HIV testing of women as part of antenatal care. Clauses legislating HIV disclosure and or partner notification is another link which is often part and parcel of criminalization legislation. For example, in Mali, there is a legal duty to disclose a positive diagnosis to either a spouse or a regular sex partner within 6 weeks of the diagnosis, whereas Tanzania's law demands immediate disclosure. There are a number of concerns and challenges linked to these trends. It is important to bear in mind that these legislative trends are often supported by women's rights organizations as well-intentioned steps to protect women and women's rights from the risk of transmission of HIV from their unfaithful sex partners. There is also the challenge that, once again, the debate as to whether or not applying criminal law is an effective response to HIV seems to center around the debate between public health needs and human rights obligations. In an area of emphasizing the need to develop evidence-based responses to HIV and AIDS, the lack of a large-scale evidence base on the adverse impact these legislative trends have on women is one of the main concerns and challenges. As these laws are neither applied in a vacuum nor are they untouched from the societal context in which they are to be implemented, it seems crucial to bear in mind women's realities and challenges in the context of HIV, as these will influence the impact of these criminalization laws on women and women's lives. We all know that women continue to be the
most at risk of infection, with statistics indicating 61% of all people living with HIV are women. Gendered inequality and power relations are persistent and continue to define, to a large extent, women's risks and vulnerabilities. And also gender violence, including sexual violence, has reached pandemic proportions in many countries, impacting both on women's risks and on its impact in the context of criminalization laws. And last but not least, women are least in the position to control their body, to control decision-making, and therefore control conditions of sex. In reality, women are therefore the ones first to know of their HIV status. Women are the ones often blamed for bringing the HIV virus into the relationship. Women are also often forced to test for HIV as part of accessing antenatal health care services. And finally, women are unable to negotiate safer sex. And all of these factors increase women's risk to HIV-related criminalization and potential prosecution. Taking these realities and challenges into account, it has to be acknowledged that, especially from a human rights and women's rights perspective, these laws are least likely to protect women, but instead are most likely to heighten women's risk of HIV and rights abuses, to heighten the risk of violence and abuse women already face, to strengthen prevailing gendered inequality, to further promote stigma and discrimination and other violation of rights, and to deter women from accessing and subsequently benefiting from available prevention, testing, care and support services. Coming back to the question as to whether or not law reform aiming at the criminalization of HIV exposure or transmission has brought successes and or setbacks, it is argued that thus far there have been no successes. However, an argument could be made that HIV-specific legislation aimed at the protection of rights of people living with HIV and not at the further criminalization and violation of people's rights would be and could be an example of how law reform becomes a success. Successes related to criminalization could therefore be defined as law processes looking or developing HIV-specific legislation which do not include specific criminalization clauses, and or law reform processes in which criminalization clauses are removed from existing criminalization laws. And as for setbacks, there seems to be many, including the adverse impact of the legislation on women, the impact of the effectiveness of AIDS responses, as criminalization laws carry the potential to reverse the gains and progresses made, the impact on the threats to human rights. And so, therefore, we need supportive legislation, not laws that further criminalize women. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We are now going to open the floor, and I would ask people to line up behind the different microphones, and we'll be taking several questions at once to talk to each of our speakers. I'd also like to, as people line up, draw attention to our point person, Jennifer Gatzi, who's sitting up at the front here, who was the person who helped put us all together. And I thank you very much for bringing together this excellent set of presentations. I do think that these presentations really do show that context is everything. And really ask, as people ask their questions, to please introduce yourself and to please keep your questions short and to the point. Thank you. We'll go one, two, three. Please.
Okay, I'm the first one. My name is Alice Jean Maymon. I'm from National Center in HIV Social Research at the University of New South Wales. I'm a PhD student. I am also a lawyer in China. When I discuss my country, that means China, not Australia. I have two questions regarding my understanding that the theme of this session is rights-based approach to HIV. Is that right? Yeah, okay. The first question is that we discuss decriminalization of sex work in the perspective of public health and human rights. As we all know that in Thailand, sex work is criminalized, but the law enforcement is very poor and almost unenforced in that country. From your perspective, we know that, of course, you are experts in HIV-related human rights. Do you think, what's your view points or comments about criminalization in sex of sex work in paper or on paper, and the decriminalization of sex work in practice? Will it achieve the same results in terms of HIV prevention with the criminalization of sex work? This is the first one. And the second question is that we discuss sex workers' human rights and drug users' human rights, women's human rights, and MSM human rights like this. As I'm also a researcher, I want to know, in the perspective of theory or in a theoretical perspective, what is the key elements, what are the key elements of rights-based approach to HIV and human rights?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank I'll take you. The question right there in the middle.
Great. Thank you. Lucy Stackpool-Moore from IPPF based in London. Thank you very much for all the presentations. They were all really interesting. And Jenny, well done. It's a really nice collection of speakers. My question is to really pick up on something Johanna said about the need for an evidence base. And something that IPPF we've been looking at recently is trying to collect some more stories about the real impact of these laws or the lack of these laws, both the punitive ones but also the human rights anti-discrimination type provisions in the real lives of different people, people living with HIV, healthcare providers, lawyers, prosecutors, judges, those kind of things. So my question for the panel is, are you aware of any really great research bases or projects on at the moment that are really trying to understand the nuances of what these laws mean in different people's lives? Thanks.
Thank you for your question. I'll take the question in the back, please.
Hi, my name is Kane Youngman from Botswana. I represent an organization called Lekhabibo, Lesbians, Gays and Bisexuals of Botswana. My question is directed to Felicita. We are all aware that of late it's been a current that one country, like the anti-homosexuality dress has been hopping from one country to the other. So my question is, what do you suggest we do to get that dress to stop it from moving from one country to the other? We all know that we cannot have a standard format to apply to every country because all countries differ. I mean, some people usually advise you to attack the government, but sometimes when you attack the government, you'll also experience the wrath of the government. That's when they push everything, like all their full power behind you. And sometimes when you just sit back, you get oppressed. So it's kind of a hard scale to balance. In our approach, right now we've tried, the approach that we're currently doing is awareness through public. We're starting awareness with public and offices, like government offices, hopping from one office to the other, hoping that maybe with time we'll reach to legislators and maybe change the whole illegal homosexual thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go right down the row, and I'll ask each of the panelists to respond to which of the questions makes the most sense in terms of your own context. Please.
Thank you. I'll take the first question. I think you wanted to know when criminalizing laws that criminalize sex workers are so weakly enforced in any case, how would what difference would decriminalization make? In the context of sex workers and MSM and injecting drug users as well, I think, decriminalization has symbolic value. It's an acceptance of our legitimacy, of these key populations' legitimacy. So it has value in terms of the political struggle for rights. So also in practical terms, the existence of the criminal law allows for human rights abuse. Often the law is not used to arrest sex workers, the particular law. But the fact that things around sex work is criminalized, or sex work itself is criminalized, allows for law enforcers to treat sex workers unequally. So that's the difference.
Just to add on that thought, because I think a similar dynamic about the support towards the criminalization of HIV transmission lies in the same moral understanding, yes, or at times even outcry for help, considering that many of HIV prevention efforts over years and decades have not achieved what we all hoped it would have achieved by now. So there is this similar misguided moral argument.
Absolutely.
But something needs to happen. And then it's often much, or it seems often so much easier to just target, in a negative meaning of the word, the actual group itself. And maybe just to pick up on the question of the evidence base, I think that the challenge right now is that more and more evidence is collected in a sense of what cases are going to court where and what other outcomes. I think where we're really still lacking behind, or where I'm not aware of real massive collection of data and research being done, is on the actual implications during the preparation for the court case, after the court case, and what actually happens in a woman's life with a prosecution and the aftermath of it. And I think it's a two-sided effort where we need to collect the evidence before we can really, at times it feels like being taken serious by particular stakeholders when we say that these laws have particular impact, and the question we get asked, where is your evidence?
Questions that were not addressed, and we still have a range of speakers that have asked for the floor. I just want to ensure that two of the questions that came up, one was whether there are elements of a rights-based approach to HIV that members of the panel think are critical components of a rights-based approach to HIV, that if that could be articulated. And so I just want to open the floor to anybody on the panel who has not yet spoken or who wishes to take.
Maybe I should just put in my 5 cents worth on that one and also address the question from Le Habibou. In terms of an enabling environment, I think for me the key part of a response that is based on sound human rights principles is addressing the underlying root causes of vulnerability. I think that in terms of vulnerability of women in particular, it's important to look at issues such as gender inequality and put in place legislation and policies that actually enable equality to be achieved between the different genders. So that's just my 5 cents on that one. I think it's very important to address, put in place legislation that addresses the root causes of vulnerability. But that's just a certain part of a response that is based on sound human rights principles. In response to the question on the recent trends in anti-homosexuality legislation across Africa, I think that, I mean, we as Aras have come to a realization that and it's not something that's new, but there's been a need for us to stop having conversations only at the policy level, but also to engage at the community level, which is where homophobia is entrenched in our societies, that we need to actually begin to have conversations in schools and in churches and in homes that preach tolerance and a respect for human beings based on the principles of just being human. I think that we've realized that there's been a tendency for us to assume that everybody is on the same page, that we all don't have different arguments for why we're in support of you know, of homophobia or against homosexuality. I think that we need to debunk some of the myths that exist and some of the fears, because I think that a lot of it is also based on fears. We also come from a society that's very patriarchal and that is very unequal and that is based on gender norms that support being macho and being the man, and what does that actually mean? And I think that we need to start having dialogues and conversations at the community level, and looking at particularly schools and sexuality education, and start to preach, you know, tolerance. And also in our AIDS response, I think we really need to challenge ourselves when we talk about universal access and things like that. But that's just a long way to answer your questions.
Further to that, for me, a rights-based approach... Yeah, for me, a rights-based approach, you know, takes sides with the poor. It takes sides with the marginalized, the excluded, the voiceless. For me, that's a rights-based approach, because in understanding who are the poor, in understanding who are the excluded. So, for example, in my area of work, I work in the area of women's rights. That's my area. That's my passion. Now, when you look at some of the laws, for example, in my country, which is the country I know best, Malawi, you find out that despite the fact that our constitution guarantees various rights to the poor, you know, like the right to development, for example, which is enshrined in our constitution, and from my understanding, that's the only constitution in Africa which has a right to development, which also guarantees women's rights. You still find out that on the ground, there are multiple myriad ways in which women are denied those rights. One of the rights is the right to property. Now, if you look at poverty, which is a critical issue in terms of Malawi, you find that women are overrepresented among the poor, and some of the things that guarantee, that continue to entrench them in poverty, is their lack of education. What does a lack of education mean for most women? It means that as they grow up, they will not have property. When they enter into marriage, it will be most likely their spouses who are bound to acquire that property. So despite their investment into this relationship called marriage, they are still not guaranteed the right to property. Therefore, poverty remains guaranteed despite what our constitution says. Now, when you look at what are the side effects, what then creates, what makes them, you know, what is the issue here? You find that there are so many side effects, one of which then is the critical issue of making women vulnerable to HIV transmission. I mean, the statistics show, if you look at generally, 61% of the women in the world, I mean, among those who are infected, 61% of them are women. One of the reasons why is because women are lesser educated, they are poorer. Now, if you contextualize that within a particular country setting, and you pinpoint, if you go right down and identify what is the critical issue here, in the context of my country, the critical issue, one of the critical, not the, but one, is the issue of poverty. Poverty meaning that with the way the laws are constructed still means that women will not be guaranteed property rights. They'll still be in poverty. We are trying to change that, among so many other things. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And what I'd like to do is just go right down in terms of each of the people standing in line, please.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Nana Oye, and I'm from Ghana. I'm a human rights lawyer and advocate. This is a very interesting theme for me because I have worked on law reform and advocacy for a while, and what I can say is that law reform, at least in West Africa, will not be an effective tool to advance, one, sex workers' rights, and also to reverse anti-homosexuality legislation. We would have to add more than that. We'd have to add education, behavioral change, and what have you. But law reform on its own will not be an effective tool. It will not be an effective tool, and I haven't heard much on morality, African values, because these two touch and concern the whole issue of homosexuality and sex workers' rights, because the act itself is perceived as immoral. So what leg are you going to stand on as a human rights lawyer or advocate to ask for law reform for something that the whole population views as immoral. And I haven't heard any such discussion. And that's why I'm very happy about Felicitas' proposals and what you have done. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, I'm Shona Horta, an independent HIV consultant. I want to thank all of you for your presentations, and particularly COD White, your interesting presentation highlighting women's vulnerability in terms of property rights and assets. I recently conducted a study in Malawi looking into the proposed HIV and AIDS bill there with Christian Aid, conducting interviews and focus groups with identified key stakeholders, including sex workers, people with HIV, and other agencies. And the results basically showed that if passed as it stands, this bill could have several negative effects. And there are some contentious issues and articles which could increase women's vulnerability, increase reluctance to test, increase stigma, and actually work to drive the epidemic in Malawi underground. And Christian Aid in Malawi is now working with partners in country to try and get some necessary amendments made. But I was just wondering what your awareness of this bill was and what your kind of thoughts on it are, really.
Thank you. Please.
My name is Mono Nyambe from the Global Network of People Living with HIV. Thanks to the panel for really brilliant presentations. At GNP Plus, we map the laws and the countries that have laws that criminalize transmission and exposure. It's more of a comment than a question, but maybe the panelists can respond to it. There seem to be sort of an assumption, I think maybe not from all the panelists, that we are in agreement on the sort of the negative impact of these laws. From my experience of working on the criminalization scan, it seems that maybe we're not, because some of these laws are actually sort of, it's activists. For instance, the laws around criminalization of HIV transmission is actually women's activists in some senses that have pushed for these laws, believing them to have on their side also public health benefits. So I'm wondering if the panel have thought, I think Felicita, you started to address it, but to have more comments on how we can sort of plug this disconnect from, it seems we're speaking amongst ourselves as people who agree. How do we speak to the other side and bring the other side to the discussion?
Thank you. And finally in the back, yes.
Hi, my name is Cindy Clay with HIPS in Washington, D.C., USA. It was discussed to talk about organizing for sex workers' rights from a labor perspective. And my question would be, in doing so, which I think would definitely improve things for a certain subset of sex workers, how do we ensure that we don't leave behind or not include or not improve the rights of sex workers who are either undocumented or who wouldn't benefit because they're not part of an organized labor movement, and how do we move together? Because it was also talked about, you know, we have to do all the laws, you can't just do some, or you have to work on criminalization from a broad-based perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to go down the panel the other direction and to start down all the way at the end. If you would start, and we'll just work our way back over this way.
To the first question about the laws against HIV, we have a practice in Russian families and women. We have a law that prohibits HIV positive women to adopt children, and we started a big campaign. And one is of our girls really wanted to adopt. Some of the picture has a, she had a brother, and she wanted to be a guardian for that brother. And thanks for information campaigns. And there were really good professionals and advocates. She could get her right in court, and she could become the guardian of her own brother being HIV positive. And the state was forced know to change this law. So once, if somebody helps us, if we are really trying, we achieve all together. It's the sex workers, it's harm reduction, and everyone together, the gays and whoever, then we force our government to come into the open. They have to change their stance, and they really have to turn to the people and to the second question. In Russian Friday, there was the first sex workers organization was registered officially. The others helped. They saved us, sort of. And now we lived up to the moment. We reached, we don't have to save us. We're now ready to work with all the other organizations who are working with prevention programs. Thank you.
Mayor, I have already addressed some of the comments that Mono had about the disconnect, so I will leave that to other panelists to respond to. But I wanted to respond to the issue of African values and how you would launch an argument. And unfortunately, the colleague from Ghana has left, so she's, you know, not here to kind of hear my response. But I think that, I mean, we have certainly begun a discussion around what are African values, and have challenged the fact that it is un-African, it's not an African value to love somebody of the same sex. And by saying that, you know, an African value that we recognize is Ubuntu, which says that a person is a person through persons and through other people, and that recognizes that I am because you are and therefore I am. And this principle, which is an ingrained African value and certainly recognized in Southern Africa, preaches humanity, and it preaches respect for other human beings. And we argue that that's a value that definitely does not support homophobia and turning against somebody else for the basis of who they are. So I just wanted to put that forward as an argument that we've used and that we're starting to consider, and a recognition that culture is fluid, and that, you know, we need to be able to challenge this and support this in terms of a response that actually preaches tolerance.
Yeah, maybe to respond some to what Mono said about that we often under the assumption that we're all on the same page in the room, and I totally agree. I think that is one of the false assumptions we often work in, and especially in the context of criminalization of HIV transmission, we have very clear experiences where the support from organizations who call themselves women's rights organizations is not forthcoming. So, yes, the potential response has to be an engagement with especially women's rights and other rights organizations to raise more awareness and create a much more in-depth understanding of potential implications if these laws are passed and signed off on, especially women's risks, because this is also the same argument from these supporters of these legislations, that these laws will finally protect women to be infected from HIV. So it is the old advocacy school of raising awareness, of engaging, of building alliances, of getting the information and the understanding of what these legislations say and what it actually means in their translation into day-to-day life, make it in such a way that it is much, much more accessible, not only to us in this room, but outside in our communities and also people who are tasked in the end to apply and implement these laws.
I'll first deal with the question about whether we are, I mean, the same one that Joanna's dealt with about whether we are, you know, we are on the same side. Perhaps not, because, you know, the whole issue of criminalization to me has always been a very complex one. And sometimes people say, I mean, I see, as the question came to say, this is coming from women's rights activists. Well, in my country, the whole issue of mandatory testing, you know, it's coming from the government. There's a bill on mandatory testing, selective mandatory testing for truck drivers, sex workers, and I can't remember another group. You know, and there's been a lot of discussion with the government on how wrong this is, and the government is adamant, says, sorry, this cannot work. But the discussion goes on. But within the same bill, you find that, in my opinion, there are some progressive elements of criminalization. For example, so certain cultures which have clearly promoted transmission of HIV/AIDS, some cultural, harmful cultural practices, which the government is proposing to outlaw. You know, and you find that those are some of the, you know, some of the areas where, you know, they are clear vectors of the virus. So then how do you balance that? Because they all come under the auspices of criminalization. For me, criminalization is a very broad subject that needs to be thoroughly discussed before we actually reach a position, because some of these harmful cultural practices are really, you know, are really difficult. But you find out that even some cultural leaders are against that kind of criminalization. So you find that the debate is not closed as far as I'm concerned. I think the debate is something that really needs to be effectively engaged with. Now, having said that, there was a question for directly to me, but I didn't understand the actual question. I heard a debate about what Christian Aid is doing in Malawi, but I didn't understand what was the question that was being directed to me. There was a lady.
Perhaps you can follow that up afterwards.
But it's a question which I didn't even get. You know, I didn't even get at all.
Right.
Yeah, but it was clear to me. I don't know if she's still here.
She is.
Yeah. Okay.
Your thoughts on the law in Malawi, the change of the law in Malawi, the HIV law in Malawi.
Oh, the same issue. Okay. Yeah. So this is you know, if you look at the Human Rights Watch website, you find that there's a contribution from Wilson Malawi on that particular issue. We work with Human Rights Watch, Canadian Legal Aid Network, on the same issue. I'm aware of the current discussion with Christian Aid and a couple of other organizations that are based in Malawi based on this particular issue. You know, I'm on their email, on the email list, etc. Although this time around we did make a contribution, because the same debate is what we made with regards to with Human Rights Watch and Canadian Legal Aid Network. It hasn't changed. But just to let you know, I think there are some top officials in government who feel the same way activists feel. It's not everybody. And it hasn't been, that bill has not gone to cabinet yet. You know, Wilson Malawi is following very clearly, it hasn't gone to cabinet. And we've earmarked some members of cabinet to discuss with them some of these mandatory tests, which is also concerning them. So it's not as if it's a closed discussion, but I'm aware of that discussion. Thank you.
Very quickly, I think in India recently, the law that criminalizes homosexual activity was read down. I mean, it meant that same-sex behavior, same-sex practices between consenting adults is no longer punishable offense. And in reading this judgment, I don't remember it, but one of the arguments that the judge proposed that if the Constitution guarantees equality, moral values or public morality cannot compromise the Constitution. So that's my response to the question of African values and public morality. Because if public morality is against violates rights of people, then that public morality has to be tempered. About the specific sex work question, if recognition of sex workers' rights as workers, whether it will leave some sex workers out of formal organized work. The idea is that sex workers struggle for recognition of their right to be sex workers, whether they're formally organized or not, whether they're citizens of a country or they're migrants, whether they are undocumented migrants or not. The demand here is to recognize that sex work is work, and as workers, certain rights are to be guaranteed for all workers, migrant and otherwise. I hope that answers the question, responds to the question.
Thank you. I'm conscious of the time, and so I realize that there are three, so very, very quickly, please. I mean, I give you 20 seconds each.
Oh, that's not going to be enough.
First, Saori White, no. I'm wondering if you can specify what aspects of criminalization you would support. You mentioned cultural practices. Can you be specific, please?
They're going to shut us. But,
Hi, my name is Laura Mumford. I'm a student at the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague. And my question is more for Johanna. I was wondering if you are aware of any situations where criminalization has been talked about in international criminal law or international law. And I was wondering if your sentiment about removing criminalization applies in situations where sexual and gender-based violence are trying to be charged to individuals in international criminal law as crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, or war crimes.
Thank you.
Or if you maybe believe that raising awareness at that level and at that type of law would be beneficial to raising awareness to women's situation in conflict-affected areas to the risks of HIV.
Thank you.
My name is Pia Jakobsson. I'm the founder of the Swedish Sex Worker Organization. And I just want to make, well, I guess it's a question because I think we are, I know shit is going, sorry, my language, it's going on everywhere. But we are sitting in Sweden and we are the country that invented a law on criminalizing the client. And we also have a very punitive AIDS law or transmission law which demands immediate information, and if you don't do this, you can be locked up for 3 months at a time, and we had sex workers locked up for years because of this, and I feel this is never addressed. We have really big problems being in contact with UNAIDS and other organizations, and I just wanted to ask specifically Nandini and Johanna whether they are aware of this.
Thank you very much. Can I ask you to please respond quite quickly?
I would criminalize harmful cultural practices. That's me. I beg your pardon?
Specifically what?
There are so many. If I had to tell you now, it is going to take long. If you just Google Malawi and harmful cultural practices, there's a report from the Malawi Human Rights Commission which actually narrates a critical harmful cultural practice which have been proved to exacerbate transmission of HIV. So that's it. Yeah.
So I managed to have 5 questions in 20 minutes.
20 seconds.
Oh, 20 seconds, sorry. Yes. I have to admit that I do not have enough information on the comparative impact of criminalization law and applying international law in relation to sexual and gender violence. But maybe that is a discussion we can take outside the session, because I see people around me who could much better answer this question. What was the other question?
Are we aware of what's happening in Sweden?
In Sweden.
Yes.
In terms of the criminalization
of sex
transmission.
Of transmission. Yes.
And the HIV law.
Yeah, not in details, but in principle we are aware that many countries, not only in the South but also in the global north, have criminalization laws in their books and are prosecuting.
Yeah, and Sweden.
So yes, and we're not, but I think that is one of the potential to actually get a voice in saying no and trying to oppose these clauses, because it's not an isolated one country situation. It really affects many, many countries all over the world.
Sweden is a horror story for sex workers, full stop. But what we need is more evidence from, because Sweden is thrown at our face all the time that they have criminalized clients, and Sweden is so brilliant and everything else. So we need more and more stories from Sweden.
Швеция была настолько большим примером, что Украина сейчас пытается отменить криминализацию секс-работы и внести криминализацию клиентов. Поэтому мы сейчас всем, вот всей Восточной Европы, Центральной Азии направляли свои рекомендации, да, используя ваши, о том, что этого делать нельзя.
Yeah, because, sorry, I was without the microphone. We want Ukraine to
thought-provoking and interesting discussion. This is the beginning of this discussion at this conference. It's absolutely not the end. So thank you to everybody here on the panel. And please, everybody, just to keep in mind that this is the beginning of these conversations about law reform, what's good about law reform, what's bad about law reform, and how is it that we can think about the extent to which public health evidence is used to justify, or whether public health is used as a justification with no evidence at all. So thank you very much.